MBA admissions veteran Dr. Christy St. John just joined Accepted as an MBA and graduate admissions consultant. Today, I'm going to speak with her about MBA admissions and graduate admissions in general, as well as specific subgroups, including veterans, international students, underrepresented groups, and I'm going to seek her insight on the impact of COVID and some schools, especially business schools, going test optional.
Welcome to Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. Your host is Accepted's founder and world-renowned admissions guru, Linda Abraham. At Accepted, our mission is to get you to that unforgettable moment when you read your acceptance email and shout, "Yes, I'm in!" Confident you'll be attending the perfect program to help you launch the career of your dreams.
Welcome to the 389th episode of Admission Straight Talk. Thanks for joining me. We're talking today to someone who has spent 25 years in international graduate admissions and specifically MBA admissions. But before I get into the nitty-gritty with her, I want to invite you to our upcoming webinar in just about 2 weeks. On Thursday, November 12th, I'm presenting Get Accepted to Columbia Business School. Register for and attend the webinar to acquire a framework that you can use for any type MBA program, as well as focused, actionable tips for this year's Columbia MBA application. Save your spot today at accepted.com/CBS webinar. Again, that's accepted.com/CBS webinar. Our guest today is no stranger to Accepted and Admission Straight Talk. She was a guest on our old chats as Associate Director of Admissions for Tuck, and more recently on Admission Straight Talk as Director of Vanderbilt Owens MBA Recruiting and Admissions. I'm thrilled to announce that Dr. Christy St. John has joined Accepted as a grad school and MBA admissions consultant. Today, she's going to share her expertise with you and me on this podcast. Christy, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Thank you, Linda. I'm delighted to be here with you.
And I'm delighted to speak with you. So let's go back. How did you get into admissions?
It was one of those peculiar things about who you know and being at the right place at the right time. I was doing my PhD at Vanderbilt, and a friend of mine in the Spanish department had been recruited to the business school to run their program that they were doing in Latin America. And when she got promoted to do that, she called me and said, they're looking for somebody to fill my former job with exchange programs, and they want somebody with international experience, and you'd be perfect. And I thought, the business school? Really? I was on my way to becoming a university professor of languages. So I went over and talked with them, and as I laugh, I tell everybody, I said, well, I convinced him that I knew the difference between Saks Fifth Avenue and Goldman Sachs, so they hired me. And I had worked in the business world before I went back to school in the U.S. and in Europe. And so it was not like business was a strange thing to me, but I never really knew this kind of job was available. Had I known, I would have started it years ago, because I had only been in the position at Vanderbilt about a week. And the dean came down to me and said, okay, you're going to go to Miami with Lori on Friday, and then you're going to South America for a month. I said, okay, let me just dust off my passport and I'll be ready to go. And so that was the start of it. And it's just been the most fun job I've ever had. It was almost like not really working, although it is. Of course, it's tiring and going through all the time zones. And there's a lot of work to do. But it's been great because I love getting to know all the students and seeing where they're from and being able to talk to them about, yes, I've been to Delhi. Yes, I've been to Seoul or wherever it might be. And that helps, I think, create a rapport with them.
Oh, sure. So. Absolutely. How many countries have you been to? I know you've been to a lot.
78.
Wow. And counting.
Yes. I've got three more that I want to go to that I haven't made to yet. But
and which three are those?
Australia, New Zealand, and Estonia.
Estonia. Okay. I've been to Australia.
Oh, good. Wow.
Yeah. It was a wonderful time. My daughter-in-law is from Australia, and my daughter-in-law got married there. So we were in Melbourne.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yep. Oh, we had a great time. You have a wealth of experience in MBA and grad admissions. How do you feel about moving to the other side of the admissions desk?
Well, it's funny because, as you know, when I was at Tuck, I invited a lot of the MBA admissions counselors up to visit us.
That's when we met.
And I got a lot of flack from schools about that. Oh, how can you invite those people? You can't do business with them. And I said, you know what? They're providing a service. And if we want them to talk about our schools to people, they need to know about our schools. And that's why I invited them. And I think it was really good, not only for the consultants who came, but it was certainly good for me to understand more about what you were doing out there. It was all a bit vague. Why do people need help getting their applications done? It's so simple, but it really isn't. It's a terribly competitive area, more so now than it used to be when I first was applying to graduate school. But it is something I think that's necessary. People don't realize that you really have to start and you stop and think about what you're doing and why you're doing it. I'm excited about being on this side of it because I still get to work with the students, but certainly on a more deeper and personal basis than I did when I was on the other side.
Right. And you can actually help them.
Yes.
Much more. Just to give listeners a little bit more context, you know, Christy very modestly, I think, went over the fact that she started that first conference. That first conference led to the founding of the Association of International Graduate Admissions Consultants. And it also, I think, led to an era of increased dialogue between the schools and the admissions consulting industry, such that today AGAC is hosting webinars from the schools for the consultants so that the consultants are better informed when they go to guide the you applicants. I was privileged to be at Michigan Ross a couple of years ago when the dean of Ross said, "We view you as our partners in developing the leaders in the business world, which ultimately are the leaders of society." So that it was quite a change, a sea change, which Christy played a major role in initiating. So a little context there. Okay. But let's get back to, you know, your role now today as an admissions consultant and as it was informed and colored by your experience for so many years as an admissions director. What do you wish applicants did before they would come to you for assistance with their applications? And you can list more than one thing, or another way of thinking of it, when you were on the other side of the desk, what was the most common mistake you saw?
I think they probably go together. And that is know why you are doing this and know what you know now. Because a lot of people, their resume is full of interesting things, but it could be so much more interesting when you start talking to them about, well, tell me about this and tell me about that. And on this side of the fence, I get to really go into detail with them. When I was working for a university, I did do some career counseling, mostly with the international students, but that's how I first found out there's so much more here. Why don't you talk about this wonderful thing that you did? Yeah. It may look small to you, but it sets you apart from other people. And when I start talking with somebody, I always say, think back, what do you know how to do? And what do you think you have to learn how to do to go to your next step? And then find the right school, because that's really important.
That school is the bridge between where you're at and where you want to go.
And there are so many different schools out there. And the reason for that is because there are so many different paths that people can take. And there's not one right school for everyone, and there's not a wrong school either, but you can have a better experience if you're at a school where you really feel like, this is me. I like these people. Mm-hmm. I feel comfortable here. And I think that's really important because you get so much more out of it. It's the same thing with a job.
Let's say the applicant has found his or her best schools to apply to. They've mm-hmm. analyzed what they've done. They've analyzed where they want to go, and they believe that these 3, 5, whatever number schools can be the bridge. How should they approach the application and the essays in particular from that point?
Well, first of all, don't assume that you can just write one essay and copy and paste it into every other school's application, right? Because each school has a, as I always tell everybody, each school has a personality, just like each applicant has a personality. And they're asking questions that fit what they're looking for or what their personality is. And it doesn't mean there's a right or wrong answer, mm-hmm. but it does mean that you have to look at the question and be thoughtful about your response. And the worst mistake that I've seen people make is to be very general. I want to do the MBA because I want to reform the U.S. healthcare system. Really? I don't think that's all going to be on your shoulders to do. You know, be realistic and have goals that are achievable And when you start thinking about your career path, because all schools are going to ask you about that, think about the fact that your first job out of an MBA program is not going to be your last job. It's just a step to many, many more. And occasionally you may have to sidestep into the job you really want. And I think it's good that people can work with consultants because you can bounce ideas off somebody who actually knows what's going on right. in the world of MBA admissions or graduate admissions. And they can say, now think about that again. Let's talk about this. Let's think about this. What about? And so if you have somebody to bounce ideas off of, you come up with a much better application, I think.
Much more robust one. Mm-hmm. One of the things I like to tell applicants is that each element of the application should reveal something different about you. Even if it's talking about the same event, let's say the same experience where you had some major achievement, one, the resume might list bare bones and results. The essay can perhaps talk about challenges, interpersonal challenges. Mm-hmm. You know, so they should each be bringing out something else. Would you agree with that?
I definitely would. And it's the same thing with the letters of recommendation. You want your recommenders to bring out, well, certainly underscore what you've said about yourself, but also to bring out other aspects from their point of view of how you work.
Right. I actually was just reviewing some material, and it was an essay and a letter of recommendation for a consultant. And I said, this letter of recommendation sounds like something this applicant wrote for another school. I don't think the recommender wrote the recommendation. Now, I don't know that she wrote it for this school, so it may not be so obvious, but if the essay that I remembered was written for this school also, then it'd be very obvious to the school that the recommender never wrote the recommendation, and that's a big no-no. So again, having a second pair of eyes can be very, very helpful. And again, approaching the application strategically where you kind of fit things into different boxes, your experiences into different boxes, can make the jigsaw puzzle application create a portrait.
It can, and that's exactly what it's for. It's to create a portrait of you that is more than your resume,
oh yeah,
more than just your essay, more than just your interview.
Or your grades and test score.
Or your grades, yeah. I think one of the things that everybody in admissions goes a little crazy about after a certain amount of time is somebody coming up to you at an event and saying, "Hi, I've got a 700 GMAT. What are my chances of getting into your school?"
Yeah.
You know, and my response is, you know, I try not to be flippant about it, but you know, if it were only a question of your scores, we wouldn't ask you for all this other stuff.
Right.
We've got better things to do than read 5,000 applications and essays, but we want to know who you are. And a test score doesn't tell us anything, really, except whether you can possibly do the work in the program.
Right. And that's why MIT just went test optional.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We'll get to that later. I'll ask you about that later. But getting back to the most common mistakes, what would you say were the most common mistakes?
Well, one thing, I wanted to go back to what you said about the letters of recommendation.
Sure.
And writing them yourself. This is something that the audience may not know, but most schools now have very sophisticated software programs for the applications. And that software can detect whether or not the recommendation letter or the essays or anything else in there came from the same computer, contains the same meta language.
Yeah.
So if you've written an essay and then you write your own letter of recommendation, the chances are very strong that we're going to know that. And if we know that, that means your application will probably be tossed out because it's a violation of the honor code for every school out there. And if you get a recommender who says, "I don't have time to do this," you go write it and I'll sign it. Don't. Find someone else.
Yeah, that's a real common problem for the applicants.
And we used to see it all the time. In fact, when we got one of those red flags, we would actually call the recommender and ask them, "Did you write this letter? Can you tell us a little bit more?" We wouldn't come out and ask like that, but we would say, "Can you tell us a little more about your statement about John? How did he really come off with this project?" And a lot of times the recommender, you could tell they have no idea what's going on.
I had at one point a very ill child, and he was being treated at UCLA's Pediatric Hematology Oncology Clinic. Oh. And one day I had gone to a conference on law school admissions, and the biggest issue in law school admissions at that point in time, this was over 20 years ago, was fraudulent letters of recommendation. You know, there's a certain amount of just hanging around and waiting there inevitably. Yes. And I was talking with the head of the clinic, who was a very experienced, very sharp woman, basically ran the place. She was a nurse practitioner. And then obviously there were doctors there, but she was really running it. She ran it. So I was talking with her and I told her about this. And she said that they had a situation where they were interviewing a fellow. So this is somebody who'd been through medical school and residency, and now obviously college, medical school and residency, and was now applying for a subspecialty in pediatric hematology oncology. He submitted his application and also a letter of recommendation from a certain, I don't know, bigwig in the field. And there was something that bothered her about this and she couldn't quite figure it out. And then she remembered the guy's on sabbatical.
Yeah.
So he could still have written a letter, but she decided to check it out. And she contacted the recommender and he said he hadn't written it and he wouldn't recommend him, wouldn't recommend him at all. So they had a problem because they had already invited the guy out to interview and they decided to let him come out. And he came out and in the course of the interview, they confronted him with the whole situation.
Oh my goodness.
And he apparently broke down and started crying about the pressure he's under. They decided not to go to the medical board. They did not go to the medical board, but they said, you have to withdraw that letter recommendation from every single university where you sent it. And of course, when you're talking about that small of a specialty, they all know each other.
Of course.
He didn't go into the subspecialty. I'm sure of that.
It's sad, but
it was horrible.
But especially in something like that, you don't want fake credentials. That's frightening.
Again, they all know each other. she got suspicious. She looked into it, and there's nothing to it.
Yeah. Speaking of that, I mean, most admissions directors, we all know each other pretty well too.
Yeah. Yeah.
We travel together. We hang out together. A lot of us have known each other for 20 more years. So, A, it's good because we all know about each other's schools. And if somebody comes up to me and says, well, I'm looking for something about X, Y, and Z. And I'll say, well, my school actually doesn't have that. But the school over there, they do. You go and talk to them.
Right.
And so we do work together on that. And we also talk about strange people who come through the door. It's a good thing. And I think it's also good for the candidates. No school wants to admit someone just to fill a seat.
Right.
Well, perhaps some of them do, but those are
different
kinds of universities.
Right.
But for the most part, we want to get a class that where each student is there for a specific reason, they're going to fit in, and that we have what they need.
Now, you began your admissions career in international admissions. What are some of the most significant challenges that international applicants face when applying to top business schools and graduate programs?
Well, there are a couple of things. One, because they're so far away, they can't often visit the school.
Nobody can visit the schools now.
Well, that's true. Now, no, that's very true. But before, very few of them could actually visit the school to know what it was like to be there. So a lot of times when the international students would arrive, we always had them come in early, both at Tuck and at Vanderbilt, so they could get their feet on the ground and at least find out where they were and how to get to from one place to another. And it's a huge pain to have to think in a different language all the time, too.
Oh, yeah.
I learned this when I went abroad. So I had a special affinity for all the international students, and I said, you know, you're going to have a headache for the first month you're here because you're going to be thinking and listening and reading everything in a foreign language. You will eventually get over that and it does get better. But just prepared. Go buy a bottle of aspirin now and because it is hard. And of course, now with the situation being what it is in the United States with the visa problems, I feel really badly for them because they've spent a lot of time. They've been brave enough to come all the way over here. They've spent the money, the time, left their families, left their jobs. And all they want is a chance to work over here for a few years. Now, some maybe want to stay longer, but trying to get a job. Companies are afraid because they don't know what the regulations are going to be and they're going to change. And so they have that big burden as well. They've got to work twice as hard as the domestic students to even get an interview.
Right. Well, let's go back to the international. So there's obviously the language barrier, and then there's the difficulty getting a job. And obviously that would be also include difficulty getting an internship as well. Right. Let's move on to another special interest of yours, and that's military. I know almost every time we've talked, that's come up. What are the most common challenges that people coming from the military face when they apply to business school, and how can they handle them most effectively?
Most of them are worried about not having a business background.
That's true. Yeah.
And they think, oh, I probably shouldn't even apply because I don't know anything about business. I said, you know, you've done inventory. You've managed $5 million worth of heavy equipment. You've managed hundreds of people. That's all you have to know. You've got more qualifications than people who've been consultants for 15 years, probably. You just have to understand how to translate your military resume into civilian language. That's the first hurdle. And then the second one is, of course, understanding the business lingo and abbreviations. Of course, they're all familiar with abbreviations because all the armed forces have their own special abbreviations for various things. So they understand that part of it, but they just don't know what people are talking about. Like something as simple as ROI.
Right, right.
Or SOP. They get it, but when they're first sort of looking at you a little bit. And I remember one of the funniest things, one of my early admits from the military was saying, everybody's going around talking about class packs, class packs. He said, I thought this was something I was going to have to carry around with me, like a, you know, on my back. And then I realized it's just a notebook of cases.
I guess every field has its own jargon.
It does. Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't realize that. So we went over a lot of that and I started doing an orientation, an hour's orientation for the veterans in the program, just to make sure they understood this is how things work and this is what you're supposed to do. Because another thing, they were not used to the fact that you actually have to get out and look for a job and you have to prepare and you have to interview. Because when you're in the service, it's just a hierarchical procedure. If you get to a certain rank and you do everything right, then you're promoted to the next one. And so they had to learn to interview and how to do research on companies and figure out what's out there.
And they really didn't realize that on coming in, or they just weren't used to doing it?
They just weren't used to doing it, and they didn't. Yeah. I think a lot of them were intimidated about that. Mm-hmm. I have to interview for this job. What do I do? And so, of course, the career office is going to take care of you. Don't worry. Go to the sessions. Most schools do have armed forces clubs, so they help each other out. And they're stars. They're usually stars.
Well, in terms of leadership, they usually have incredible leadership, self-discipline, sense of responsibility, mission.
Absolutely. And service. I mean, that's another thing. A lot of times they weren't really sure what direction they should go in. And you suggest something. Well, I've never done that. Well, that's okay. That's why you're here.
That's why you're in school.
Yeah.
I don't know is not a terminal condition.
No, it's not. Right. That's a very good phrase. I like that.
Right. Now, you've served on the Consortium for Graduate Studies and Management's Board of Directors and as a liaison to the Management Leadership for Tomorrow. Both groups serve African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and Native Americans. What advice do you have for those underrepresented groups in management, in particular in business schools and also in graduate schools?
Apply. We need you. We need your thought. We need your perspectives. And don't be afraid. A lot of times, because of the test scores and things, I've talked to some candidates with fabulous work experience, and but I can't, you know, I don't do well in standardized tests. And a lot of times, they would be denied by schools because of their test scores. And I just always found that horrible because, as you know, the test score will tell you a certain amount whether you'll pass the first year of the program. It doesn't say whether you're going to be a great business person or not. It doesn't say whether you've got a strategic vision or not. It just says, can you do the quant stuff? If you're worried about that, go take a class at your community college or something online, even a free class. Don't let your fear keep you from applying and from trying to go to the best school possible. And don't be afraid to ask questions. Admissions counselors and admissions staff are there to help. in the most cases, and this goes for everyone, we're all looking for a reason to get you in, not to keep you out. Sure. And that's very true. Even for schools that get 40,000 applications, they're looking for the best people to bring in. And also financial concerns are a big issue for a lot of the underrepresented minority population and for women as well. Don't worry about that. Finances will, they'll work themselves out. If you get into a good school, don't let that stop you.
Well, I think I've also talked to several admissions directors and they basically said, you never know the price of the program until you're accepted.
That's true. And a lot of people don't think about that. And then suddenly they think, I've got to come up with how much money? And yeah, it is frightening. But
I'm not saying they should ignore the potential costs at all, but the potential for merit-based aid that only comes through once you're accepted is simply an unknown. And you're not going to know that till the end. Now, again, I'm definitely not saying ignore financial planning, because please do not read that in.
But
you can't assume that the price tag, if the price tag is too high at the end of the day, don't go.
That's right. But there are lots and lots of opportunities out there for funding at low interest rates. And for the most part, if you're going to a renowned accredited university, you're going to make that money back.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to be able to pay off your loans in probably 10 years. And that may sound like a long time, but you're going to be doubling your salary in a lot of cases. So take out a loan. Go for it. You're worth it.
Now, we've touched on this a little bit, but let's like kind of go head on. In your opinion, how is the coronavirus affecting and going to affect MBA admissions and business schools?
I think it is having a very definite impact on admissions, because suddenly the schools that were requiring people, you've got to come here to do your interview, they can't do that anymore. Oh, we want to meet you, and we can't. Luckily, we have the technology we do so that we can at least see people via Skype or Zoom or some sort of, you know, online recruiting events and that sort of thing. But I think it is going to make us think, there's got to be a different way to evaluate people. What can we find out about people? So I think you're going to see more schools doing some video essays. That's becoming a trend in a lot of schools in the past 5 years, but I think you'll see more schools doing that, so they can get a feel for you. And I think that on the other hand, the candidates really have to make an effort. Go to these webinars, reach out to students. And that's one thing that I always tell anybody I'm working with. Every single school out there has a bevy of students who are ambassadors or whatever they may call it, peer counselors, whatever. And you can find them on the website. And these are the people who have the inside information. Reach out to them. They can give you so much more information than an admissions officer about the day-to-day life, right, about what's going on, about do you like the classes that you're taking? What are new things? What's life like there daily? What do you think about your classmates? What kind of clubs could I get involved with? I mean, granted, admissions officers know this, but it's different getting it from a student. And if you make that effort to get to know a student and to ask them questions, when you do your essays, you're going to have a lot more depth to your essays. We're going to understand you are interested in our school. You do know about this thing that is not on the website. So the only way you could have found that out is through a student. And that's good. We like that. And it's good for you too, because you may find out details that, say, an admissions officer might never tell you, and you could change your mind. Ooh, I don't think I want to go there after all. So that's the key thing. But I think now that all the schools, not all of them, but a lot of schools are going test optional, that is a huge breakthrough.
You're anticipating my next question.
Yeah.
More schools are going to go test optional? And what will be the impact of going test optional?
Well, it's certainly going to hurt all the rankings magazines and their fake rankings. Yeah. I think trying to rank or whatever a business school solely on the basis of it, what your incoming GMAT score is.
I don't think any of the rankings did it solely on that basis, but they did it based on, you know, various statistical inputs.
There's a lot of that too, but yeah, that seems to play a bigger part than the job market. I mean, or the career placement part of it, which is really the important thing. That's why you're there, to get a new job, right? That should be what that's based on, or what employers say. I mean, I know that all of that goes into it, but
well, the Business Week ranking, I think, most closely mirrors what you're talking about, with Financial Times kind of coming close, and Forbes on some level.
But, and the Wall Street Journal, when the former survey did, that was good. I do think that the GMAT and the GRE can tell us a certain amount about, can this person do the work? Because on the candidate side, by studying for the GMAT or the GRE, you're going to be refreshing your knowledge, let's say, of quantitative problems that you will see when you get an MBA program.
Right.
And this is good for you. But I also think that I'm happy to see a lot of schools now accepting the executive assessment, because for candidates, especially for, like, let's say, for military candidates who've been in the service for 10 to 15 years, and they want to do an MBA program because they want the immersive experience. They don't want to do an exec program. They've been out of school for so long. Are they going to remember high school geometry? No. So I think the executive assessment might be the right tool to use for some candidates. And I'm glad to see that more and more schools are accepting that.
Oh, yeah. I wonder if for the schools that go test optional, I think it'll help those people who are weak test takers, no question. And I know I've talked to people who say, I'm struggling with the GMAT, I'm struggling with the GRE, but I'm actually supervising MBAs.
Exactly. And they probably do strong quantitative work, and they might, I mean, I've worked with somebody who had like a 3.8 in finance, and he couldn't get above a 550 on the GMAT.
Wow.
Because of test anxiety or whatever it might have been. It wasn't because he didn't know how to do the work.
Right.
And so
right.
I think in cases like that,
yeah, the test is a negative. But I also think that for those people who maybe did poorly in undergrad school, or maybe didn't go to such a great undergraduate institution, then the test is an opportunity for them to show, I can measure up.
Exactly.
And,
exactly.
You know, that's going to be a little bit more of a problem. I also suspect that the work experience and essays are going to count more if you're talking test optional.
I certainly think the work experience will.
Yeah.
And not just the quantity, but the quality of that experience. Because I used to, again, that's a question you get a lot at these MBA fairs. You know, well, I've got 5 years of experience. Is that enough? Well, you know, it may be, but depends on what
gas?
You
did.
Were you making photocopies and nothing else, or what were you doing?
Flipping hamburgers?
Exactly.
But anyway, I think the whole test optional thing, do you think more schools are going to go test optional?
I think they will. I mean, especially if COVID continues on so that they can't get into the test sites. Because just, was it this week or last week? Last week, I think GMAT made the announcement that, okay, if you've done the online test before, you couldn't take it again. Why? And now you can, but only once.
Yeah. Right, right.
Why?
Do you know why?
No, no idea. I think it's because they don't know how to set it up. And it does.
I was thinking they have a set of a bank of questions that may be more limited for the online version.
Yeah. I think they're just very, very worried about fraud.
Yeah. Yeah.
They should be. If that's the case, then let's throw it out.
Right. If it's not working, it's not going to do any good. What about MBA reapplicants? We've talked about some different groups in the MBA applicant pool. What advice do you have for MBA reapplicants?
I love reapplicants because it shows me that they are persevering in their desire to do whatever it is they want to do. What I don't love is somebody who gives the same application they gave the year before without any changes.
Right.
That just tells me you're not terribly self-aware. I would say take
a hard look. Definition of insanity?
There you go. Possibly, yes. Doing the same thing over and over. And I've had those, and I know other admissions directors have too. You get the same application year after year after year, and you tell the person until you're blue in the face, you really have to retake this. You really have to rewrite your essay or whatever it might be. And they just don't do it. Take a hard look at it. You know what's wrong. You know where your weaknesses lie. If you're honest with yourself, you can say, oh, yeah, well, maybe I shouldn't tell them I want to go into private equity since I have never done anything in finance. I've only been, human resource director. Maybe I should think that over.
And if you can't figure it out, you should ask us.
Exactly.
That's
what admissions consultants do. They're going to look at it and say, you know what? You don't have the background for this yet. But it doesn't mean you can't ever do it. But you don't have the background yet. So let's start off here. And I think one of the one of the things is that oftentimes at an early point in your career, you don't know what's out there. Everybody applies to an MBA program. I want to do management consulting. They don't even know what it is, but that's what MBAs do. I want to do that too. So there's so many things that you will discover. And I think that's why I've always told people the MBA is the most useful degree that you can ever, ever get out of everything out there and all the professional degrees, because it prepares you to do anything.
To lead anything. That's for sure.
You develop a network. You learn about how each part of a company works with the other parts and what they do. Because some people don't know that. They could work in the same company for 50 years and still not know what the marketing department does. Sure. And so that's why I think it's the best degree that anybody could get. So I urge everybody to go out and get an MBA now.
Okay.
And come and work with us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What do you wish I would have asked you that I haven't asked you?
Maybe why I keep doing this.
Okay. Why do you keep doing this?
I really love working with the candidates. And although I haven't had as much experience on this side of it as on the other side, that's one of the things that makes me really happy at the end of the day is when I've been working with someone and they call and say, I got in. I can't believe it. I got in. Thank you. And I said, you know, I didn't really do anything. You had it all there. We just had to direct you in the right way. And then I'm still in touch with a lot of the alums from the very first class that I recruited. And seeing what they have become now, watching them grow, watching them, their families, they progress, they move around. It makes me feel like, okay, in some small way, I've had a tiny little effect on somebody.
So sounds like a big
one. That makes me feel good.
Right.
I also learn a lot from all the candidates, and I'm a big proponent of learning every day something, even if it seems totally useless at the time, you never know. And so I love to listen to their stories. I listen to what they've done and find out why they did something or how they got into something. I just think it's fascinating. I think human nature is intriguing.
It is. And human experience is fascinating also.
Yes.
That's what we get windows into. Yeah. Christy, this has been absolutely great. Thanks you so much for joining me today. As always, I've really enjoyed talking to you. Nothing that hasn't changed since 2005 when we first met at that conference you organized. Listener, I want to thank you too for tuning in. You can learn more about Dr. Christy St. John on her bio page at Accepted. I'll link to it as well as to her contact page from the show notes at accepted.com/389. And if you'd like her to advise you individually, she is currently available to guide you as an Accepted consultant. If you found this show helpful, I have a favor to ask. Please share your thoughts. Just go to lovethepodcast.com/AST. And that URL again is lovethepodcast.com/AST. You'll be able to rate and review on iTunes and other leading podcatchers. Doing so helps potential listeners find us and is very much appreciated on our end. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.